There is nothing magical about decades. A decade is a convenient way of marking time. So, throughout this book, when I discuss decades, this book is the product of a crisis in education, a crisis in education of the 70s. A decade is, there is nothing magical about a decade, about tens. Testing, testing, testing.
It wasn't Sunday. They'd all gone to town and left me there. I was 9 years old, and I'd had my first suit of clothes at bullet. That is all I ever wore before that, or my grandmother made. I was pretty proud of them. They cost $4.75. Bought off what they used to call in those days a Dutch peddler. Had a horse and cart, came around. Well, I was due to wear those to church next Sunday. They were all gone. Nice day in the spring, sunshine, and that swamp lake back of the house, half naked perhaps, was 2 or 3 feet of water, and I had some old lumber in there, a raft, float. My tendencies always took the water. I wanted to be on the water. That probably is why I became a sailor later on. We were overwhelmed with cats. We had 12 or 15. I had an old Newfoundland dog that would do most anything I told him to. Of course, I couldn't think of much to tell him, so he didn't do too much. But this day, it occurred to me that I'd been told that cats couldn't swim. I was always investigating those things. People told me stuff, and I'd go to any lengths to find out what I was doing. Got me some boxes that had to lay boards on for covers, put them on the raft, and I caught every darn one of my cats that I could find, 14 or 15 of them, put them in those boxes. Got the old dog on the raft and pulled out at the middle of that place, and then I took the covers off and shouted, "Scat." They didn't scat. So after 2 or 3 efforts along that time, the old dog, he got up over him and he let out one of his booming barks, and they scattered. They scattered in every direction. I went off backwards and came to and waded shore in that black muck. I put that new suit on for the trip. Let me advise you, that was a mess. And I thought, now I'll lie down here, let that dry out. Well, I did, just a close fit anyhow. I laid down, fell asleep for an hour or so, and when I started to get up, I had my own suit on. I couldn't hardly bend or anything, but I did finally bend. The buttons flew in all directions, and the suit dripped, and oh, dear, what a mess that was. Well, right nearby, I saw an old pear tree, one of those old standard kinds that run up like a flagpole, 25 or 30 feet in the air, and I was string cats up that tree, right the whole length. I was just totem pole, just like totem pole, with 10, 12 cats. I never forget that scene. But in the past, we finished the hay harvest. A neighbor joined hands, and we finished the hay harvest together. We talked about going to Apex on a blackberry trip. That had all been cut over just at the right time so that blackberries grew there in the greatest profusion. In fact, the largest blackberries I've ever seen grew there on 400 acres. So, this day was Friday. Saturday we got the hay put away and got the wagon changed over, got a box on the wagon and everything. We took on the teams and we went up there blackberrying. I never in those days ever went anywhere, but I always carried some fishing tackle. You never know what you'd do, where you'd bring up or anything of that sort. I always had some hook and line and stuff like that. Now this, you got some salt handy? This neighbor, John Lawson, and I, we went berrying. And, well, all I had to do was just pick them out of the house. We got our repaired everything we had full before noon and came home. Saturday night, of course, Saturday night, we went down to Townsville in the little old store. I'd give $1,000 if it was in existence today. I'd like to have you see that one. That was one. But we went in there, and I'd assume there's 25 or 30 villagers gathered in there, old-timers, you know, and they're always inquisitive, and anyone from the country drove in. They want to know what we were doing. We told them we'd finish saying yes, and today we went blackberry. Blackberries ripe? Is there lots of them? Oh, yes. Well, there's lots of them, yes. Just stop and think. John had more education than I had. He was graduated from Delaware Franklin Institute, and he could spin a good story. He launched out of his story, and I corroborated the evidence. Why, he said, we went up there before noon, we picked that wagon box full. He said, I measured the box last night, and it runs 21 bushel. Just full dumping pails right in, you know, right in the box. Then, he said, we picked six cards, piled them up, you know, to dry. We're going up a couple of weeks and get them. Piled them up in piles like you pile wood to dry, you know. Got that all done before noon. Right away, some of them said, what did you do in the afternoon? We went pickerel fishing on the lake. There's a big lake, a 100-acre lake. And caught 24 pickerel. How'd you get out where the water was deep enough for pickerel? Why, I said, because all the lake's all frozen over. The ice hasn't gone out yet this year. The ice is 2 feet thick there in the lake yet today. Well, we told that story, I chipping in a word now and then, you know, and the old timers, they looked at each other, the pitying sort, you know, and their stories would be confined to the one that had the biggest turnip in the garden, or one that had his hens laid the largest egg, or so on and so forth. But among the audience, over in one corner, was an alien, no question. He was an alien to Cairnsville. He was well-dressed and stood up all the time. Never said a word, looked around, young chap. All right. Monday morning, first thing I heard is, take that pair of horses down and get them shod. Go early. Get ahead of someone else to blacksmith shop. So I did. Abe Constable run the store there, and Abe, as the story runs, was offered $10 once of each mile, but he wouldn't. He couldn't see a joke or anything of that sort. So I drove to the shop. Just as quick as I got out, Abe come from the store up there, you know, and he came as near smiling as I ever see him. He says, without any preliminaries, he says, did you see that young man in my store Saturday night while you and that Lawson up there was telling that awful story? Hey, Mr. Constable, by the way, he supported the Presbyterian Church in Cairnsville, and he meant it all right. He was a good, honest, gentleman chap. I said, yes. I said, didn't see anybody introduce him to us. So we can pay attention to him. Well, he said, you know, that's our new minister. He said, do you want to know what he said after you two fellows went out? I said, yes, certainly. He says, Mr. Constable, is that the type of people that I'm sent up here supposing to save? was told me by an old colored man who was known as the harness maker out of Townsville. He was, at the time he told me this story, he was an old, feeble man, a boy of 12 years old. His story goes on to state that he was born in slavery in South Carolina. He had, however, they had a very good master. He had school for them, and every one of them, before they would learn some trade. He learned the trade of a harness maker. He became a young fellow, a harness maker. With the opening of the Civil War, he was taken in the army to repair harness. After the Emancipation Proclamation, he made repaired harness in the Union Army. He was taken over by the Union soldiers, Sherman's Army. At the close of the war, he eventually reached New York, where he finally secured a job working on the Erie Railroad as a fireman. And eventually was assigned a position of a regular run between Port Jervis, New York, and Susquehanna, Pennsylvania. He was fireman on trains 1 and 2, which was known then, as is today, the Chicago Express. This story now that I am relating is George's story. Well, you see, it was like this. We were coming up one day in March along the West Branch between Calicoon and Long Eddy. A few flakes of snow were falling. Occasionally we saw a raft of lumber in the river. Everything was going fine when all at once, no warning whatever, something happened. We all jumped. The engineer, I, and the engine. The engineer and I landed on the roadbed. The engine went off the road and slid down in the river. Just the smokestack sticking out of water. Well, the train crew disembarked and came up, and the passengers all came up. Standing around, couldn't anybody think of anything that could be done. Just that silent feeling, everybody just looked and they said none. All at once a shout came from upriver. Everybody pulling for Jersey. Well, there was a big double raft coming down the river. They were pulling in to get as close as they could to us. Well, they finally pulled in, a man went short of the rope and snubbed the raft to stop just above us. And the pilot was an old chap named Frazier from up Rock Driftway. Well, says he, looks like you boys had a little trouble here and you needed some help. I don't know. Maybe we can do something for you. Well, everybody looked at each other and wondered what we could do and so on. Well, he says to you, I told the boys we'd make Pond Eddy tonight. But I believe, he said, we can help you get this engine back up on the rails and still make Pond Eddy. Well, they went back up the raft and they got some timber off and brought it down there and run the, they had a lot of big timbers and everybody joined in. They run one end of them down into the river under the engine and the others up on the, to the rails. They'd spliced the ropes. One man went dove down, went under the boiling engine, put the rope around it, up back on a tree, brought the rope down the river. Now, he says, we'll go up and cut the raft loose, and when we get down here, will you throw us a rope? We'll make a handspike snub, and I believe we'll put it up on the track. And that's just exactly what happened. Everything went up on the track. George says, I just as quick as it got up there, I jumped up on the engine, and I went to firing up.
And the riflemen sat down below and got their ropes and timbers and so on. Why, almost no time at all, I had steam up. And just about the same minute, the steersman shouted out, "Pennsylvania." We started for Chicago. And had quite time firing up the wet wood. That wood all soaked up, and the worst yet, just as we pulled inside the Hancock, I threw the last stick in the firebox. But the train crawled into the station. Hancock was a wood station. They had wood piled up there, firing. Everybody joined in and loaded up the tender with wood. The conductor came up. He called up to the engineer. He says, "All you got to do is keep her wide open." And he turned to me and he says, "George, you throw wood like you never threw wood before." And he says, "Don't try that foolish stuff of saving out the crooked sticks to fire the curves with. Just chuck them in." Well, we started out. No one saw Hey Lady. We went by, we were going so it, and no one saw Hey Lady, and no one saw deposit. They'd announced that they wouldn't stop because they were late. Right through deposit. Deposit never saw the train at all, but they did after a while see a swarm of ashes and cinders come down all over town. Got in Susquehanna, joined dispatcher, came out there and raised Gain. He said, "Do you fellows know you're 21 minutes late?"
The people of Kazrilovka had to cope with some of the same problems we have today.
"So, you're being drafted to Mars.
It's nothing to be depressed about.
Look at the possibility. One of two things can happen. Either they'll make you a secretary, or they'll send you to the front. If they do, what could happen? Either you'll get wounded and become a cripple for life, or you'll die altogether, right? Even if you die, you'll become a hero, right? You'll have a big, beautiful funeral. The rabbi of Vinnytsia will come, and Esther, and Zippin.
Zippa?
Even she.
What about Malka?
No, Malka won't come. She married Getzel the peddler.
Oh, yeah.
Zippe, Frasio.
That's nice.
So you see, there is nothing to worry about, right?
Right. But what if I live?
Then you have a problem.
Shlomo Aleichem were writing today, he would probably be writing about the waiters, the cab drivers,
I don't know who Shlomo Aleichem is,
the clerks, the grocers, and the tailors, who came to America and worked their 12-hour day so that their children would not have to do the same. And now it's their children in the suburbs who have to read English translations of Shlomo Aleichem's simple Yiddish and allow him at best an historical acceptance. Although Shlomo Aleichem has been translated into many languages, the true beauty, subtle meanings, and compelling rhythms are best appreciated in the original language.
Yiddish.
The van then to the Lumen Kasurke, Otwell has. A Inda no man, who says jeder inne, what is voice nimmet. A Hana gemeiner man, a gemeiner man.
Among all people, the cemetery is a serious, very frightening place. To Kozrilovka, it was the place where closest friends and relatives were buried, and that's where they are if you have to talk to them. There were some old scholars and even some very well-known men buried in the cemetery at one end of town. These were not the people whom one spoke to. You spoke to your tante, your grandfather, your mother.
Oh, Mother, if you could only see what has happened to your daughter, the apple of your eye, your baby, me, Gittle. If you could only know, Mother, how I and the little ones suffer. You'll never suffer like I do. You're lucky. You don't have the problems I do. I shall never forgive you for making me marry Fischl as long as you live. Didn't I know you were going to die when I needed you the most? I said to myself, watch out, she'll die. Just when you need her the most. And didn't you die? Well, who knows better than you do? I wish I could change places with you, Mother. I wish I were you and you were me. Yeah, but I'm not like you. I wouldn't leave me alone by going off and dying. And who can complain? As they say, things could be a lot worse. Those who make up those statements should spend a day with Fischl. Well, Mother, I'll see you next week. Yes, I guess you'll be well.
Besides being the place where one could talk to friends who never listen to what you have to say in life, and now in death have no choice, it was always important for Jews of Kozrilovka to be buried on Jewish soil.
There are many theories as to why the Jewish people have lasted all these years. Some of the answers are found in Sholem Aleichem's work, persecution, sorrow, and a sense of humor.
Right? Right. May you buy a pair of fine leather gloves and may they both be left hand.
We've asked you to put on a short sock, the length most men wear, and Burlington's new mid-length sock. The mid-length uses Lycra in a very special way so it covers your shins, yet can't slip. Can't get that sloppy look. You can't make it fall down. Make Burlington's new mid-length sock fall down. Your shiny shins will never show.
Ah, oh, man, the eternal dreamer, the fighter for a fresh, unruffled bed each night, now has victory in his hands. It's over. It's over. It's over. The nightly nightmare of wrinkled sheets is over. Now, Burlington Never Never Iron Sheets are here. Without ever ironing, they're fresh and smooth to start with, and they come back each night fresh and smooth again. It's what every man's been dreaming of. And every woman. Burlington Never Never Iron Sheets. No bed should be without them.
Burlington Sheets, just one part of Burlington Industries. If it's anything to do with fabric, we do it at Burlington, and we do more of it than anyone in the world.
This is chicken soup.
This is a Megillah.
And this is a Megillah.
This is an actor.
That's an actor. That's an actor. This is chutzpah. This is chutzpah.
This is Sholem Aleichem.
My name, Sholem Aleichem, is a good one, since it also means peace be with you. And as you know, everyone uses my name to say hello. Makes me feel good to hear it that much.
Oh, once they had a contest. They needed a new greeting. They got tired of hello and how are you. So they wanted to say something else to meet a person that would be interesting and amusing. So somebody proposed they should say Shalom Aleichem. Another person proposed that they use Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai, and they voted because that would take too long to say and they couldn't get any work done in the fields. So it became Shalom Aleichem, became the greeting. Shalom Aleichem, Aleichem Shalom.
Is that a true story?
No, not true.
Shalom Aleichem.
Aleichem Shalom.
Are you Baron Rothschild?
Who else? What are you peddling? Clothes I don't need, and banks you're not selling.
For the man who's got everything, I can sell you eternal life.
Well, let me hear how a peddler can sell me eternal life.
For 300 rubles?
Okay.
For eternal life, you should leave Paris and move to a little town called Kozrilivka, where I came from.
That's going to give me eternal life?
Maybe not. Would you settle for a knish?
I might like that.
The translation of the term Shalom Aleichem is two words, a Shalom and a Lechem. And Aleichem means to the bunch of you. And Shalom means either hello or peace or Stanley or Seymour. So in other words, Shalom Aleichem means hello, peace, Stanley or Seymour to the bunch of you.
Is that a true story?
No, that's not true.
So then what are you saying?
I just made something a joke to pep you up inside.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I changed my name, too. I didn't mean to, but I saw an ad in the paper. It said, improve your personality. So I went to see the man. He told me my personality was okay, but my name was my problem. I said to him, how can a name be a problem? Even William Shakespeare said, what's in a name? He said, who? I said, William Shakespeare. He said, look, you want to listen to me, you want to listen to your friends.
Sholem Aleichem's influence extends from Kozrilivka to American television and nightclubs.
She's a comic.
10 feet of snow on the ground, nothing moving, nothing, no night fit for man or beast. Yet despite that, here's a little guy with boots up to his hips, 3 overcoats, 4 sweaters beneath. He walks into a bakery shop and he says to the baker, give me 2 rolls. The baker says, could I maybe interest you in 1 jelly doughnuts? He says, just 2 rolls. The baker says, a cookie maybe? 2 rolls. Baker says, you mean you left your home on a miserable night like tonight for 2 crummy rolls? He says, that's what I did. Baker says, tell me, you married? He says, well, Dan, my mother would send me out on a night like tonight.
This is a Schwarzer comic.
Funny, he doesn't look Jewish.
This is a Ganef. This is a Meshuggah.
I said, wait a minute, suppose I use the name and I don't like it. Can I bring it back? He said, of course. All I ask is one thing. While you're using the name, don't give it a bad name.
May Misha the peddler sell you a poisonous white fish. Gay and drowned.
May your daughter marry a convert. And after the first child, may he convert back to Christianity. And name the child Mike.
If you uncover any of these curses uttered by any of the women in Kozrilivka, you can find all of the love imaginable between two people who have shared all of life's trouble in the world and in each other's arms. It's natural for a man to curse, so why try to hide it? If you want to hear people speak badly about someone, just mention the name in Kozrilivka of Yasha, the butcher.
Excuse me, Yasha. I hope I'm not disturbing you. I realize you're a very busy man. You have a lot to do, but if I could just have a moment of your time, I would like to ask you. Do you have any fresh meat today?
I have rotten meat. I deliberately pick up rotten meat to serve my customers. If you want rotten meat, you can have it. Do I have fresh meat? Food then. When I was at the slaughterhouse today, I said, make sure you give me rotten meat, because only some people like fresh meat.
But could you be so kind as to give me a good portion?
Just the kind of portion you deserve. Tiny, like your head.
Yasha the butcher may be stubborn and eccentric, to say the least, but what's interesting is his customers won't go anywhere else.
This is a chicken? This is terrible, Yasha. What kind of a chicken are you giving me here? Look at that. Look at that chicken. What kind of a chicken is that? A skinny, emaciated chicken.
Do you think it's such a big treat for the chicken to look at you?
As I say, he's honorable but stubborn as an ox. Even looks like an ox. When he chops the meat, he's like a killer. As menacing as he is all year round, on the day before the coming of the new year, by some miracle, he turns into a lamb.
Yasha, may I have a piece of meat, please?
For you, my dear. You who bring the sun into my butcher store with your very presence. For you with a smile that helps keep the world warm. For you the largest and best piece of meat. I'd like to apologize for all my sins this past year.
The same to you, Yasha. May God forgive us all, and perhaps if you have time after synagogue, you can join us for a piece of holiday sleep.
Thank you very much, and have a good New Year.
Of course, the day after Yom Kippur, he starts all over again.
When a carcass like you asks a carcass like me...
Everything was a little different in Kozrilivka. The rabbis were not only intelligent, but could solve problems beyond your wildest dreams. Sholem Aleichem himself studied when he was younger at the yeshiva. One of the things he wrote about was the absent-mindedness of the rabbis.
I can spot a learned man in an instant just by the way his thumb dips back and forth in the air.
Then I woke up this morning, I said to my wife, let me have some breakfast. I kissed her on the cheek and noticed a different texture to her face. This could only mean one of two things. Either my wife had overnight turned into a piece of wood, or since there was no answer when I asked her for breakfast, it could mean that I didn't have my glasses on and had kissed the bedpost.
Sometimes when it's used to clear up a point of logic, it becomes an explanation point that ends all argument.
You know that my rabbi converses daily with God? He says, hello, God. How are you, God? And God says, thank myself, I'm fine. How do you know it's true? Suppose it's a lie. Would a man who converses daily with God tell a lie?
If God rewarded people in the afterlife by how much they drank, then Chlavna would be sitting in the highest rows of heaven and the rest of us, without fail, would be warming in hell. As it is with most people of Chlavna's type who like to take an occasional drink every 2 minutes, he didn't have a penny to his name. His wife Gittel, who could with one glance sober a keg of wine, would only have to look into Chlavna's direction to supply him with reason for more drink.
From now on, I'm going to collect all the money that you make from your shoemaking so that we can have a little something left over for food, if you don't mind.
What is this, a jail? What am I, a thief? What, are you crazy?
God forbid in this day and age I should turn to my husband and call him a thief. You're not a thief. You're a drunk. A thief I can live with. You can talk to a thief. You can get a hello, how are you, from a thief.
Do I hurt anyone? Do I rob anyone? I like to drink. I like to drink, yes. How else do you live with a woman who has an answer for everything?
Go to the market for me. And make sure you don't lose your way and stumble by accident into some tavern.
Why? Why don't you lead me by the hand and dress me and put on my heavy mittens? The marketplace is that way and the taverns are that way. And who in the middle of the week on a working day when there are shoes to be mended would go out for a drink?
Toasting the world and drinking to every one of God's creatures as they occurred to him in succession, Chlavna left the tavern, and no matter how many corners he turned, home was never near him. It felt to him like the sidewalk and the street had conspired to play hide-and-seek with his house. There it would be in front of him with all the flickering candles and windows. He would take another step.
What is this? Where am I? Who put a wall in front of me? I've been in this town for 40 years. Who put a wall in the middle of the street?
A wall is a wall and not a wife.
Where is he? Where could he be this late? He's been drunk before, but he always makes it home. Well, what if he's dead? Well, God forbid. All his teeth should drop out. All except one, and in that one he should have a gigantic toothache. What can I do with him? Oh, what can I do without him? All right, some man takes a drink. Does that hurt anybody? Is he a thief? Please, God. If you were married, you'd understand. When he gets home tonight, I'll make his favorite hamantash, and I'll put him to bed and shut out all the noises from the outside world out there. I'll kill him. I'll kill him. Will you please bring him home safely?
This is a herring. This is a blintz.
That's a blintz? That's a blintz.
This is a pupik.
This is Zoptic.
Oh. May you buy a pair of... Rip, rip. Get right.
Right.
All right.
There is a very thin line between great humor and pathos. Shalom Aleichem was a master at walking that line. He created the character of the Shlemiel, the character to which everything happens, whose only defense and shield is to laugh at himself.
It's amazing to me how some people never succumb to the sadness of events around them. Fischl the tailor lost his store and his merchandise in the big fire in Kiev. And when you see him today, he greets you the same way he always had, cheery, interested in your well-being. He was not just a moon-faced, simple person who would smile to flowers. He was a tailor. He could fix a patch that could never be detected. He could take an old threadbare coat and turn it into a fine gabardine. And he would take the fine gabardine and turn it into trousers. He would take the trousers and turn it into a jacket, and he would take the jacket and turn it into something else again. And for everything, he had a quotation.
Torah says you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him sit.
I ask for money and he gives me quotations. I'll give you a quotation.
The Bible says a man with a quotation is better than no man at all.
If you must know, I wouldn't trade all your quotations for a good plate of hot borscht with a cold potato.
Fischl, the tailor, had no trouble matching pants to a jacket. But for the people of Kazrilivka, making a match for marriage sometimes required a professional.
Hannah Baylor, the matchmaker, said...
My dear Reb Yossi, Hannah Baylor, the matchmaker, never says anything. The words pour from her mouth like peas from a sack, or like rocks from a landslide.
This tea is rich, like wine.
Chana Baylor said that.
No, I say it.
Of course. As I said, Chana Baylor never says anything.
Some more preserves for your tea?
No, thanks. About the match, your daughter Rachel...
Matchmakers talk about girls like we talk about the cow being brought to market.
Your daughter is beautiful.
Better a beautiful woman than an ugly one. God himself must hate ugly women. If he didn't, would he have made them ugly? And your son, Mendeleev. Oh, solid, like a mortar wall.
Earning good money. He'll provide well. But Hannah Baylor says that the dowry you're offering with your daughter, it seems lacking.
My daughter Rachel is beautiful, healthy.
She eats like a horse.
Gifted. She is gifted, bright, modest. She has a good education.
Chilin Wolf, my friend, I don't know how to tell you this, but my son Mendeleev saw your daughter Rachel taking Russian books out of the library and talking to Gursky, the Gentile.
Yassi, there is nothing to worry about. I trust her. Yeah, she's well educated, so she's a bit modern, but I know how to handle her.
What do you do?
I am very liberal with her.
Liberal?
No, of course. You have to be with modern children. I lock her in her room. I allow her out only 1 hour a day. I keep her glasses so she shouldn't read. But one has to be liberal, Yossi. Yeah, that's why I give her the hour.
Rachel, I wish the matchmaker would hurry up and make the match.
My father is very strong-willed. It may go on for a long time.
It's sad to have only this 1 hour each day.
It is sad. The negotiations could go on for a long time. My father is a good man, but having the strength of a bull, he has a stubbornness that more than equals it.
After the marriage, we'll have more time.
Oh, yes. Mendel would never be as strict as my father. He wouldn't mind my reading with you and studying foreign languages. Mendel will be a good husband to me. He's very solid, you know, but understanding. I think. Oh, Petrov, why are you only known to everyone as Gursky, the Gentile? If only they could know you as I know you, full of the love of words and books.
My daughter is no more. Why do you ask about my daughter? I have no daughter. She married the Gentile. More than that, he has no real trade. Traveling from house, doing anything to make something. I think weird that my wife secretly gives them some cheese and flour with some kopecks hidden inside. They would never even get by. A well-educated girl, and all she's doing now is washing and baking and cleaning and scrubbing and scraping day and night. But you ask her and she says, the house is full of love. The dishes shine and smile back at her. So go complain. You can slave for them, give them everything, try to make a good life for them, but not for modern children. They know better than the wisdom of age. The dishes smile back. Oh, the baby smiles better.
Shlomo Melechem was a modern in his time. He was Jewish, but not as the Reformed rabbis say in their austere tones, of the Jewish faith, but Yiddish. Yiddish in the bone
and to the teeth. But also Yiddish in a different sense. Like Charles Dickens, Johann Bach, and Ray Charles. Yiddish in the way that black people use the word soul. The kind that transcends its ethnic background and becomes the world's gift. Shalom Aleichem has soul. That's why his works still have meaning. His characters are never grappling with more than the problem of just getting through the day. In getting through the day, they talk to God, themselves, their cows, and to us. And we know that somehow these are the real people, not the phonies. Like Dickens, Bach, and Ray Charles, he loved to perform. He appeared on tours in which he read from his own work. People flocked from all over to see him. He never failed just by simply reading his own stories to bring the audience to its feet and to bring more acclaim to his already legendary name.
As you know, my father, Yankel the Cantor, died on the first day of Shavuos, and I was left an orphan. My brother and I started saying Kaddish, the prayer for the dead, immediately. He's a good brother, but he's a bad teacher. He's very quick-tempered, and he hits me when I make mistakes. You know, everyone in that house has a nickname. They call me Muttle with the Lips. Lippy, where you been? Lippy, wipe your nose. It annoyed me. And then I'd start crying. Pessie's husband asks me, why are you crying? Because my name is Muttle, and they call me Lippy. He asks, who called me that? And I tell him Beryl. He went to Beryl, and Beryl said it was Chaim, and so it went. One blamed another, and another blamed the third. Like a circle without an end. He finally laid them down one by one and gave each one a good frusk. I'll show you how to make fun of an orphan. And that's the way it goes. Everybody comes to my defense. You know, I'm lucky. I'm lucky I'm an orphan.
Planted in your mind becomes a part of your imagination forever.
And you know 10,000 people like Muttle, the tailor, and 20,000 mothers like Gittel, and 20,000 traits and mannerisms that are like yourself, like your wife and your children, in every one of his stories. Sholem Aleichem died 1916 in New York City. At his funeral, thousands of people came to pay their last respects for a man whom they all felt they knew personally. The people who came were the dairymen, the waiters, the clerks, the people who embodied the spirit of Kasrilivka, all the people he had written of. It was as if they were asking who was to speak for them now that Sholem Aleichem was dead, and who was to remember them if he was forgotten. In his will, you get a true feeling of the kind of man he was. He wrote, "Wherever I die, I should be laid to rest not among the aristocrats, the elite, the rich, but rather among the plain folk, the toilers, the common folk, so that the tombstone that will be placed on my grave will grace the simple graves about me, and the simple graves will adorn my tombstone, even as the plain people have during my life beatified their folk writer. If my children on the day of my passing should not be inclined to say Kaddish for me, be this against their religious conviction, they may be absolved therefrom, only if they all get together with my daughter and grandchildren and good friends generally and read aloud from one of my stories, of the very happy ones, and recite it in whatever language is more intelligible to them. And let my name be recalled by them with laughter, rather than not be remembered at all."
Next week, see Star Trek in color at its regular time.
Beginning Sunday, February 16th, on most of these stations, NBC Experiment in Television will be seen weekly at 4:30, 3:30 Central Time. On February 16th, Color Me German, photographed on location in Bavaria, a moving story of an American Negro teacher finding his black German boy nephew in Munich. That's February 16th at 4:30, 3:30 Central Time here on NBC.
When I left Lev's office, I got home just in time to be greeted by my mother-in-law. A nice woman, but very boring. She could stop a war with one of her stories and put both armies to sleep. When she's in the midst of one of her great lies, just before the climax, when you're not really listening, she lets out a sound from inside of her involuntarily, like... It's always in the guise of clearing her throat, but it's actually God's way of letting us know that all we've been listening to is a big lie. Thank you for listening to my story.
Burlington, and we do more of it than anyone in the world.
The New York shippers have filed against the Longshoremen's Union as the dock strike goes through its 48th day. I'm Jim Hartz.
And I'm Kyle Rode. Princeton moves into sole possession of the Ivy League lead. Stay tuned for the 11th hour news, weather, and sports next.
If you could put Tarryton's charcoal filter on your cigarette...
I'm just curious to see, just not that I want to preserve it.